continuing on first canto, and where we left off yesterday was canto 1, chapter 7, where the whole discussion with Narada and Vyasa is completed. Are you too a little familiar with Bhagavatam?
A little bit.
Okay. Vyasadeva compiled Srimad Bhagavatam. And the sages of Naimisharanya asked, it's a one space for had assembled after Srimad Bhagavatam had been narrated by Shukadeva Goswami to Maharaj Pariksit, and the purpose of their assembly was the age of Kali had begun. The age in which Krishna appeared was Dwarapa Yuga, and after Krishna's departure, that marked the beginning of the next Yuga, Kali Yuga, where quarrel and hypocrisy grow abundantly. All good qualities of mankind deteriorate, known by winter season or something. So, knowing that Kali Yuga was beginning, they planned to go to Naimisharanya in the forest and conduct a 1,000-year yajna, spanning over many generations, just for the purpose of diminishing the influences of this bad age. Because the life of sages was to serve others. And when they had that assembly, in the midst of their assembly, came Sutta Goswami. Sutta Goswami was the son of one of Vyasadeva's disciples named Romaharshan. Romaharshan, when Vyasa compiled the different parts of the Vedas, he entrusted the different parts of the Vedas to different very qualified disciples that they should preserve and propagate the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda. And Romaharshan was put in charge of the Puranic portion of the literatures that Vyasa compiled, and his son was Sutta. So Sutta had heard the Srimad Bhagavatam from Shukadeva Goswami. He was in the audience when he spoke to Maharaj Pariksit. So the sages were really excited. Let's hear, you heard. Not only you heard, you understood. Not only you understood, but you've assimilated and realized all of this wonderful literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, which we've never heard. Please describe this wonderful literature. So, one of the questions the sages asked was, could you describe how Vyasadeva first went about compiling the Srimad Bhagavatam? Because it came, the essence of Bhagavatam was there with his original writing, but the full 18,000 verse version came later. How did that happen? Can you describe? So, in the process of describing how it happened, there's this whole dialogue between Vyasa and Narada. Narada Muni is the spiritual master of Vyasa. So Vyasa said, he did his thing. He compiled all the Vedas. And he sat back from that exercise after a long period of time and thought within himself, how did it come out? Like you do something. You didn't put the crowns on Jagannath. How does it look? When you're cooking an offering and it's all done and now you're curious, how did it come out? Or whatever, you're doing something, you're writing a paper for some project and spend a lot of time and then you step back and say, how did it come out? But he was doing that. How did it? When he saw the work and he looked within himself, he felt missing? What's missing? Why am I feeling this way? We all know what that feeling is. There's this pinch in the heart that says, something's not right. But I don't know what it is. So he inquired from Narada, what happened? Why is this feeling there? So Narada, there's this long conversation that we just completed and went on from yesterday morning. Narada has explained that essentially knowledge alone is not enough. Knowledge is good. And you got A+ in the knowledge department. But that knowledge which does not directly, or anything that does not directly awaken our loving relationship for the Supreme Person, it's incomplete. And that's what you're feeling. And if you're feeling that, what to speak of anybody who reads what you wrote, your readers, they're going to feel the same. So you should compile one literature that specifically glorifies the name, fame, qualities, pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You don't have to repeat all that other stuff because you already did it. So just do that. Just focus on that. And he gave him an assignment. A nice homework assignment. And then he used his own autobiography of his previous life, of how he became Narada. Because Narada's not a writer as in a principal way. He wrote some things. But his gift is different than his disciple Vyas. Vyas is a literary person. And Narada is a speaking person. He travels and he speaks the message. And Narada and Vyas writes the message. So we each have our calling. So he showed through his own experience how he came from a nobody, a completely obscure village boy, the son of a Shudrani, who didn't even know who his father was, to the position of being Narada. So that he gives an explanation of the evolving of consciousness to the stage of perfection. So essentially he's saying, as I have done, so you should do, and here's the made very clear what the steps of spiritual elevation are and what the ultimate attainment is when it's consummate and complete. So Narada left. Gave his assignment to his disciple, Vyasadeva. So Vyasadeva did exactly what Narada told him to do. He purified himself, sat in a trance of mystic meditation, his mind completely completely fixed upon the personality of God, and saw the Lord. And his realizations are described in those verses. And based upon what he realized, he then wrote Srimad Bhagavatam. That's how he's answering the question, how did Vyas manifest the Srimad Bhagavatam? And then Vyas taught it to Shukadeva Goswami, his son. Because he entrusted the other portions of the Vedas to other qualified rishis and munis. But he gave the Srimad Bhagavatam specifically to Shukadeva because of Shukadeva's very, very special qualifications. Not just because patronizing his son, because of Shukadeva's quality. And then the sages say, wait. Why did Shukadeva Goswami, who has no interest in anything material, take interest in Srimad Bhagavatam? Because he's a liberated soul. He's already there. So why does he need to study something? And then the Atmarama Shloka, very, very prominent verse, is presented where it's often repeated and often quoted, and it's a key verse in the whole of the Bhagavatam, where Atmaramas is the Atmaramas Chambunayo Nir Grampi Api Arukrame, etc. So Atmarama means one who is finding satisfaction within the self. Rama, Atmarama, one who finds pleasure within oneself, does not need to find pleasure somewhere else, because the pleasure is already on the platform of the soul. So the verse says even Atmaramas take pleasure in this Srimad Bhagavatam because it's of the same nature as that Atmarama, that spiritual happiness. Meaning, the topics of Krishna are on the spiritual platform. So persons on the spiritual platform are attracted to topics on the spiritual platform. That's why he had interest in it. And therefore, the whole subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam is being confirmed as of the same platform as the soul, or the same platform as the Supreme Soul. It's fully spiritual literature. There's nothing, by Narada's instructions to Vyas, there's nothing material, like, you know, how to fulfill this desire, how to fulfill that desire. You do this ritual, you do that austerity, you do this penance, and you get some material perks. It's all that's absent in Srimad Bhagavatam. So then, since the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam is Krishna Katha, then the sages who are hearing all of this from Sutta say, essentially, Krishna Katha, please. A big order of Krishna Katha. Please speak about the topics of Krishna, because anything that you have to say, Sutta, is going to be conducive to that. Just your association. We're excited to hear from you, Krishna Katha. So the first topic of Krishna Katha, where this is not just summarizing what we said yesterday. Already the Bhagavatam has introduced Krishna as Param Satyam. The Bhagavatam has introduced the process of devotional service as Paro Dharma, the topmost form of religious activity, and the topics of Krishna as on the pinnacle, the apex, the culmination of all of the spiritual subject matters. So now, with all of that announcement or preparation, Krishna enters for the first time in the whole of the Bhagavatam in chapter 7. Krishna is directly going to be spoken about, and not only that, Krishna is going to directly speak. And the situation is, it's unfolded, is answering another earlier question: how did the Srimad Bhagavatam appear? It appeared by Maharaj Parikshit hearing it from Shri Padma Goswami. So Krishna protected Maharaj Parikshit when he was, before he was even born, when he was still within the womb of Uttara, his mother, the posthumous child of Abhimanyu, because Abhimanyu was killed in the battlefield mercilessly, but the child was already within his mother's womb, or his Maharaj Parikshit's mother's womb, or within Uttara's womb. So he's going to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, and Krishna protected Maharaj Parikshit. But also, Krishna shows in this chapter 7 topic his affection for his devotee and his protection for those that take shelter of him fully. He shows it several times. So the scene is, Sutta narrates that the Kurukshetra battle was over, practically speaking, because Duryodhana, his legs had been broken, he's in excruciating pain. The Kauravas have already been wiped out. The Pandavas are practically victorious. So Ashvatthama, the son of Drona, decides he wants to get back at the Pandavas, and he wants to please Duryodhana, who isn't dead yet, but he's finished for fighting purposes. His legs are broken. So Ashvatthama goes into the tent of the Pandavas, and the dead of night, the small children, the five sons of the Pandavas, he cuts off their heads with his sword and brings their heads before Duryodhana, thinking, look, the descendants of the Pandavas are now finished, here's their heads. You should be very pleased with me. Although you haven't won the battle, they've effectively won the battle, but they won't be able to pass on the kingdom to their sons, because here's their heads. Duryodhana was disgusted. And when Arjuna found out, Arjuna wasn't just disgusted. Arjuna came before Draupadi, who was crying. All of her five sons were dead, mercilessly slaughtered. Arjuna took a vow, I'll capture Ashvatthama, and I'll bring his head before you, so as you're performing the funeral for your sons, pouring the oblations into the funeral choir, you can stand on his head while you do that. And Arjuna went for his chariot, got his weapons, and chased Ashvatthama. This is where we ended yesterday. Ashvatthama's horses were tiring. Arjuna was in hot pursuit, and just to save his life, he turned, and with his brahminical powers that he had learned from Drona, his father, he released Brahmastra weapon and directed the Brahmastra weapon at Arjuna. So that's where we ended yesterday. Arjuna then turns to Krishna and offers prayers, because what does a devotee do? It's a nice lesson. When there's difficulty, most people panic or run in fear or freeze, like this expression of like a deer is caught in headlights. Just what to do? Or resource your material intelligence, how to, you know, work around this difficult situation. But devotee, because by nature they're feeling themselves dependent upon and protected by the most powerful person, Krishna. Arjuna immediately turned to Krishna. So this morning's very nice topic, it's two parts. How does one become fearless? Or for that matter, how do you overcome any material tendency that's just so strong it's compelling? Like anger, or lust, or greed, or any bad quality, bad habit. How do we overcome bad habits? Everybody's got their share of bad habits, or material tendencies that just kind of, they're just there and they don't seem to go away no matter what we do. How to go beyond the compelling force of even things as basic as instinct. Like things that you don't even have to think about. You don't have to think about your heart beating or digesting your food or things that just happen because they're physiological. So similarly, the animal propensities of life, defending is the strongest, fearing and defending, and you know, some attack is coming, and your adrenal system goes and you do something. What do you do? How do you understand that the compelling forces of nature? That's the topic, one of the topics. another is, why does Krishna appear? Because in Bhagavad Gita, there's a nice verse in the fourth chapter where Krishna says, Janma karma cha me divyam evam yogeti tatvatah. If we can understand tatvatah in truth, why Krishna appears and the transcendental nature of his appearance and his activities, that alone is sufficient to free one from material existence. Chapter Deham Purnar Janma 19 Mamiti Sojana. Upon giving up this body, Chapter Deham Purnar Janma Na, one doesn't take birth. So, in this section is, why does Krishna appear? What's the transcendence? So, by understanding this little nice subject matter, it's sufficient for one way ticket, the spiritual world. So that Vyasa teaches those two things. Krishna's protection of his devotee, and by that protection, carrying one on the other side of fear of material existence, or the forces of material nature, and the transcendental nature of Krishna's appearance in this world, and is being disclosed by Arjuna. He's offering prayers to Krishna. So the one that we read yesterday is text 22. Arjuna said, O my Lord Sri Krishna, you are the Almighty Personality of Godhead. There's no limit to your different energies. Therefore, only you are competent to instill fearlessness in the hearts of your devotees. Everything and everyone in the flames of material miseries can find the path of liberation in you only. So he's using a metaphor. Material existence is compared to a blazing fire. And Mahaprabhu also used a similar metaphor. Mahadavagni. I was thinking this since coming to Minnesota. Why aren't there forest fires in Minnesota like there are in California? There's more forests in Minnesota. Not just because it's hotter in California. Why is there the blazing in all these rich areas too? Well, this one is in Big Sur, like posh area to the max. All these $1 million homes burning down. Blazing fire. And you know, they've got all this. Just noticing as we're driving here. They made preparations. They have all the little fire hydrant things. It's the law. You have to, you're going to build a house, you have to have some way to put out fires. You know, fire hydrants. But the fire hydrants, when there's a blazing forest fire, fire hydrants, good luck. You're not going to put out the fire. Just on the way coming here. I had a flight from LaGuardia Airport through St. Louis Airport. There was, you know, those CNN things, you know, the airport terminals. They were showing men trying to put out these fires in California. All the, you know, the trucks, and they, you know, they have all these techniques because they're getting lots of practice. They start a controllable fire over here, downwind of it, where the fire is moving, and they burn it out so that by the time the fire gets to that place, it's already burned out, so it can't catch on to the next place. So they build a little fire that they can manage, put it out, and then the big blazing fire can't spread, except if it's so huge and the wind is strong, it just carries the flames beyond that patch and the next thing, and just keeps going. Anyway, so they have to attempts to stop the fires, but the, so the metaphor is this whole material existence, the the suffering of material, the unwanted suffering of material existence is like a raging fire. So Arjuna is saying, you're competent, you alone are competent to extinguish that, the fire of material existence. So then he carries on, that was yesterday. Here's why that is so. You are the original personality of Godhead. He's talking to his friend, Krishna, on the same journey with him. Who expand you, but who expand yourself all over the creations. And you who are transcendental to material energy, you have cast away the effects of material energy and think of your spiritual potency. We're always situated in eternal bliss and transcendental knowledge. So that's a nice verse. Sounds, you know, poetic and very nice. Let's see what Arjuna is saying. Mayam yudhasya chit chakya. So, chit shakti. There different potencies that the Supreme Lord has, and his own spiritual potency is his chit potency. And that chit potency, or swarup shakti, chit shakti, swarup shakti, they mean the same thing. It's fully spiritual, and so by the influence of spiritual potency, the material potency is cast far away. Vyudhasya means thrown. The example is that where there's light, there's darkness. It's dark of night, and you can't see anything, but if you turn on the light, then the light is stronger than darkness. So darkness is dispelled by light. And so where there's Krishna, there's no darkness. The influence of darkness is dispelled. Mayam vyudhasya chit shaktya. The darkness of material existence is driven away by the influence of Krishna's spiritual power. Arjuna understands that, and there he is, right next to Krishna. So that means the influence of, how does fearlessness come about? Not by bluffing, or by being macho or something, by being in the presence of Krishna. Knowing that the influence of ignorance is gone in the presence of Krishna. Because fear, there's a nice, in the purport, nice explanation of what is fear, or what is darkness. If we don't know, we're in ignorance, we don't know that the soul is eternal, then we can be afraid, some harm can come. So in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes it very clear. The soul really doesn't have anything to fear, because the soul can't be cut by any weapon, or moistened by water, or withered by the wind. It's not affected by anything material. Because there's the material elements. Earth, water, fire, air, and ether. But the soul is not. It's another energy altogether. It can't be influenced by a knife, earth, or water, or wind, air. It's non-physical. So as physical things change, they come and they go, it doesn't affect the soul. The soul is transcendental, so there's nothing to fear. If by Maya's influence we forget who we are, we abandon who we really are, and we think we're something that we're not, then That's where fear lies. Fear lies in ignorance. If I think that I'm this body and some danger is coming to this body, then I have some fear. But if we're understanding this is knowledge, if we're understanding our real identity as spirit soul, there's nothing to fear. Prabhupada would sometimes give this example of Socrates. And when he was being condemned to death because he was the Greek rulers at the time, he was so popular and so powerful, he didn't line himself up with the government because he was aloof. So they saw him as a big threat. So they put him in jail. But you know, they were afraid to do anything to harm him because people would have revolted against them. So they said to him this famous thing, you know, that if you really believe in this idea of the soul, then we challenge that. You prove it. You take hemlock. You drink poison. And so he drank poison, saying something, some epitaph is there, something to the effect that you may want to harm me, but first you have to catch me. And he drank the hemlock. And there's this passage where he's describing to his students, who are crying and crying because he just drank poison, how the effect of the poison was acting upon his body. So he was not unconscious of what was going on the physical plane, but he was detached from what was going on in the physical plane because he was fully convinced of, and that's just philosophically, convinced of the identity of the self as non-physical, fully spiritual. So knowledge alone is not enough, is the message from the previous section of Vyasa's compiling of the Vedas, because the Veda needs knowledge. But he wasn't feeling satisfied even though he was full of knowledge. So here in this verse, Kaivalya Stitta Atmani, because Krishna not only represents knowledge, but he's full in himself. Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Knowledge is there, but Krishna is the Supreme Person. And he's Stitta Atmani. He's in pure knowledge and bliss within himself. Kaivalya Stitta Atmani. A similar term is used in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter, where Krishna is describing the position of the self-realized soul, and he uses the phrase stitta pragya. Stitta pragya, stitta atman, very similar. Stitta pragya means where one's consciousness is fixed. When consciousness is fixed, Arjuna asks in the second chapter, what's the symptoms of someone who's stitta pragya? And there are several verses in which Krishna explains basically they're not influenced by duality. Hot and cold, same as earlier, pleasure, pain, you know, whatever things of duality there are. Happiness and distress, good fortune, ill fortune. In terms of external things, they're indifferent, they're aloof. How is that aloofness established? Like Socrates drinking hemlock, being afraid of, being unafraid of losing his body. He is recognizing he's not this body. You may want to punish me, but first you have to catch me. They caught him. They caught his body, put his body in jail, but he was free. So freedom from fear, or freedom. This is going back to chapter 6 of this canto. There's a theme about freedom. It appears earlier, Prabhupada describes that everyone desires full freedom, where we're unfettered, like poetically, like a bird flying in the sky. We hanker for that unrestricted freedom. But how do you get unrestricted freedom? Because we're bound by the laws of nature. You know, at least the body is. So it's a paradox that the whole position of devotional service hits on or highlights. Freedom comes with surrender. But surrender sounds like, oh, it's bondage. But the surrender is only the surrender of our bondage. We surrender ourselves from a false sense of independence to a sense of being in a loving relationship with Krishna. So just like husband and wife, or any other relationship where you bind yourself to another person. And only when that commitment to the other person is made is there the opportunity for an exchange of love. If I'm independent, and he and she are independent, they're thinking independent, then what does marriage mean? Or what is a friend and friend? I'm not bound to you, I just do what I like. And as far as, you know, you satisfy something that I want, we're friends. You stop satisfying what I want, see you later. I'm going somewhere else. So a relationship that's beyond what I want is a relationship where of love. It's where the other person wants. And voluntarily I choose to find my happiness in what the other person wants. And the other person is finding happiness in what the other person wants. And then there's exchange of love. I'm giving up some so-called freedom in order to gain the freedom that's found, or the happiness that's found in love. And when that same principle is reposed upon the Supreme, it's ultimate freedom. It's full freedom. The example that's given in chapter 6 is Narada. Narada isn't, he's not bound by convention. Look at this, we made some space. Got a front row seat. Narada is not bound. Prabhupada gives this example. For us to move from one place to another place, we have to walk or ride or do something. Narada doesn't, he has such freedom, he doesn't have to do that. He just plays upon his veena, which is, according to Agni Purana, is an instrument directly given by Krishna and is fully spiritual. Even the sounds of his veena are spiritual. And when he plays the sounds of his veena and calls the names of the Supreme Lord, the Lord appears in his heart and he just like, zoom, zoom, off you go. Doesn't have to worry about the cost of fuel. No energy crisis problem for Narada. And he doesn't need visas and passports. And it's not even he's restricted by, you know, this planet. He can go to any planet in creation. He can go beyond creation into the spiritual world. He has such freedom. Who has such freedom? He's as free as the Lord himself. And what was the price for that freedom? He surrendered to the Supreme Lord. But what was that that he surrendered? It sounds like bondage, not freedom. You surrender. Like, you know, wave a white flag. I surrender. I'm captured. You're now my master. My independence I give up. But that false independence, that spirit of independent from the Supreme Lord, place that at the feet of the Supreme Lord. I am yours. And to the degree that submission and love is there, it's like, you know, between a loving relationship with whatever, the friend and friend, or parent and child, or husband and wife. When there's true loving relationship, there's a bondage of love, but within that there's a freedom of experiencing the happiness of love that one is not going to experience otherwise. And there's a sense of freedom, but there's at the same time a sense of commitment in that relationship. You're bound, but freed from the suffering of unfulfilled desires for happiness. And what to speak of when that's reposed on the Supreme Lord. That's what Arjuna is saying. Because of your Krishna, because of your qualification, by the influence of your chit-shakti, your spiritual potency, the covering influences, the darkness of material existence is thrown far away, just like by the presence of the light of the sun. Darkness is dispelled. And Prabhupada explained very wonderfully. What's darkness? By definition, darkness is the absence of light. So, in one sense, darkness is created by the absence of light. Or the other way around, just like darkness of night. Does it mean, he doesn't say this here, but at length, when it's night, on the other side of the planet, it's light. It's not that the sun went out of existence, or does not exist. It's just there's an object blocking our vision of the sun. And when that object blocking our vision of the sun is removed, then you can see the sun. There's light. So darkness is nothing but a creation of light. And so when you're in light, there's no darkness. When you're in the presence, similarly, you're in the presence of Krishna, the suffering that's born of the darkness of material existence, this blazing fire of material existence, is extinguished. So metaphors like that are used to help us understand. Metaphors are for the purpose of something that's beyond our direct experience. It points in that direction. That something that's beyond our experience is alluded to by something that's within our experience. And it's like that. So the nature of the soul is to be beyond material existence. How do we regain that original nature? By being in the presence of Krishna. I'll repeat something that I mentioned yesterday, just to like amplify the point. Of the forces of the instincts of life, defending is the strongest. The Vedas describe there's four instincts or animal propensities. You have to eat. When you're hungry, you have to eat. When you're tired, you have to sleep. There's an urge for mating, and there's an urge for defending. And of those four, defending is the strongest. Because if you're eating, sleeping, or mating, and there's an attack for your safety, you stop those things and you defend. So how to overcome this urge of defending? Here comes this Brahmastra, Arjuna saw, blazing, lighting up the whole sky like hundreds of sons and is headed right for him, and he's what do you do? Defend yourself, right? You do something. But Arjuna is fearless. He turns to Krishna. And he says, the position of fearlessness is possible only through you. Why? Because you have spiritual potency, and you are spiritual potency. You're replete in spiritual potency, and in that spiritual potency, the ignorance that's the cause of fear is gone. Therefore, his conclusion is, or his statement is, only in you is it possible that one can be fearless. Just like the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita discussion about stitta prajna. How to go beyond duality? How to go beyond anger? People ask these things all the time. Maharaj, I've got this anger problem. What do I do? I've got a greed problem. What do I do? Well, I've got a lust problem. What do I do? I've got an addiction problem. What do I do? I've got a problem. What do I do? So how do I become stitta prajna? So it's possible. I had this discussion with my Ayurvedic physician. He was kind of a... He knew that I'm a devotee, so he was making reference to Bhagavad Gita about, you know, Ayurveda teaches, through the assistance of Ayurveda, one can become stitta prajna. And I put my foot down and said, no. You can bring the material energies in balance through Ayurveda, but unless the consciousness of the soul is fixed in the Supreme, that balance is going to become imbalanced in a short time, and you know it. As an Ayurvedic physician, you can bring the doshas into balance. You've got that science. And then you send your patient back to their home, and what happens? Because their consciousness is not right, their life habits are not right, they go back to imbalance. You've got another sick patient again. It's a good program. You just keep bringing your patients to you. But you, so it's consciousness change. It's when consciousness becomes fixed upon the Supreme. It's through linking with the Supreme, through yoga, through taking full shelter in the personality of Godhead. Then you have stitta prajna, because the Lord is stitta prajna, or here, stitta atmani. That's Arjuna's understanding. By your presence, I can be protected from fear. Then he goes on, and yet, although you are beyond the purview of the material energy, you execute the four principles of liberation characterized by religion and so on for the ultimate good of the conditioned souls. Thus, you descend as an incarnation to remove the burden of the world and to benefit your friends like me, especially those who are your exclusive devotees and are wrapped in meditation upon you. I mean, he doesn't say, Krishna, you're all powerful. See that, Brahmastra? Help! He doesn't do that. He knows that Krishna, this is, whatever is happening to one who's fixed, like Arjuna is fixed, if some obstacle comes, we all have the experience, some things, life is going along reasonably okay, and then all of a sudden, something. Some calamity, some obstacle, some difficulty. There's a U-turn in the road. What happened? So, this is an instruction for us. Here's how our consciousness should be fixed. Immediately we should turn our attention to Krishna, as Arjuna is doing, and recognize that if we're fully dependent upon the all-powerful, spiritually potent Lord, there's a solution to this. Ultimately, nothing can harm the soul. So, just a little review. Why does Krishna appear? In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives three reasons why he appears. Kritranaya Sadhunam Vinashaya Shaduskritam Dharma Sangstapanartaya Sambhavami Yuge Yuge, 4th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So he comes to Kritranaya Sadhunam to give Trayate to deliver the devotee. And Vinashaya Shaduskritam to admonish the Duskritis and to establish principles of Dharma. Dharma Samsthapanartaya. So here Arjuna is saying, you do for those reasons, yes, but the real thing is, you're devotee. You're present with your devotee to deliver your devotee from the whole of the material circumstance, the fear of material circumstance and material circumstance. All the complexities. And here comes this complexity, zooming at me, this invincible weapon. And you come, your presence is for deliverance from those circumstances. Not just so that the Brahmastra goes away, but that so that I can be with you. You're bringing this happiness into my life. Svana Ananya Bhavanam. Svanam Ananya Bhavanam. You come exclusively. Because Krishna can take care of eliminating miscreants. Just send some disease or hurricane or cyclone or something, tsunami or earthquake or, you know, something. They're all gone. And someone as an agent of Krishna can come to do something for giving some protection and speaking spiritual knowledge for reestablishing Dharma. Krishna can do those through agents. He comes personally for the satisfaction of the personal reciprocation of his devotee. Loving exchange. That's why Krishna comes. And because he's svanam ananya bhavanam, the devotee becomes fully satisfied. Anujyanaya chasakrit. By repeatedly remembering the Supreme Lord through the presence of chanting or his qualities being described like we're doing. For a devotee, that's the real happiness. They don't need the solving of the problems or the getting of the things that they don't have that they want. Because they don't have that hankering for things they don't have. Their hankering is for a loving relationship with Krishna. Just like us. You know, when the relationship, the very close relationships that we have in life are loving, we're satisfied. We need something else. We gotta get another something else. Or the other way around, you can have so many something else's, but if they're loving relationships, the relationships are disturbed or broken, then where's the happiness? Have so many things. Meaningless. So place that same principle in the ultimate sense in loving relationship with Krishna. Arjuna is fully satisfied because Krishna is by his side. And because Krishna is loving, he makes some arrangement for Arjuna to be protected. And that's one of the senses of being with an all-powerful person. You're protected. You have to think about it. You're protected. There's a sense of being safe. There's shelter. Because one has taken shelter, you're sheltered. So, and that's so the message of this section is how to overcome our material shortcomings, which we all have without exception. We all have our little, medium, and big things that they're shortcomings that are what we would like to be, what we understand we would want to be. And we're less than that. How do we overcome that? By full shelter in Krishna. Up to death threat, our existence could get wiped out. Material existence. So, very, very valuable lesson. And in tomorrow's verse, Krishna is going to speak, just like in Bhagavad Gita. There's some dialogue in the beginning in chapter 1 where Arjuna and Krishna are talking like friends. And then, starting in chapter 2, Arjuna takes shelter of Krishna and asks him to instruct him. So that's when, in one sense, Bhagavad Gita really begins, when Krishna instructs Arjuna. And then, in the fourth chapter, Krishna starts speaking about himself, transcendental knowledge. So same in the Bhagavad, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, all of this preliminary is to introduce da-da-da-da, here's Krishna. And he's being introduced by Arjuna. Da-da-da-da. Now tomorrow Krishna's going to speak. Stay tuned. His first word spoken in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So our acharyas have, it's such an important thing, Krishna's appearance and Krishna's first words being spoken. Our acharyas have commented specifically on these verses. It gets like a lot of attention. I wanted to express what Sridhar Swami and Jiva Goswami have written, and we'll end with this. Sridhar Swami is the original commentator on the Bhagavatam, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu referred to Sridhar Swami's commentary as the standard. Anyone who expresses something about Srimad Bhagavatam, it has to be held up to the light of Sridhar Swami and what he has said. So here's what Sridhar Swami has said about what we just discussed. Speaking in the first person on the Lord's behalf. So Arjuna has spoken to Krishna. Now here's Sridhar Swami saying, and here's what Krishna is feeling after hearing Arjuna's words. That's pretty confidential, huh? The Lord states, isn't it that removing the burden of the earth happens just by my wish? Meaning, what stops, what does Krishna have to do? He doesn't have to do anything. He just wishes something and bhavati. It is. Maya jakshina prakriti suyate sacharacharam. By his adyaksha, just by his glancing, things happen. Or stop. So, Krishna doesn't appear to like make things happen. He's got to hurry up and get over here and, you know, stop a problem. That's not why Krishna comes or doesn't come. Just by my wish, isn't it that things happen? Thus he notes, Sridhar Swami notes, that Lord Krishna does not need to personally appear in this world to remove the burden of the earth. He can do that simply by wishing it to be done. So, what is the actual reason for the Lord's appearance? Arjuna is declaring it you descend to benefit your friends, especially those who are your exclusive devotees and are wrapped in meditation upon me. So Sridhara Swami is, through his commentary, explaining what's the transcendental reason for Krishna's appearance? To reciprocate loving exchanges with his devotees. One who understands that does not take birth again in the material world. According to chapter 4 of Bhagavad Gita. Then the other commentators, Jiva Goswami, and Jiva Goswami, in his, he's written 6 sandarbhas. Sandarbhas are very special, unique style of composition. It's not verse by verse like many commentaries are. It's topic by topic, and the topics are very systematically organized. So Bhagavad Sandarbha is, like it's, it implies, it's about how the Bhagavatam reveals Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead, the personal feature of the Absolute Truth. So in his Bhagavat Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami comments as follows. O Lord, you have formerly appeared as the Purusha avatars and other incarnations. You have now appeared the Tayam avatara in your original form as Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You have appeared, it seems, to remove the burden of the earth, planet. This is directly from the Sanskrit of the verse. Bhuvo Bhara Jihir Shaya. Bhuvo Bhara Jihir Shaya. You have come to relieve the tribulations of material existence. For your great devotee, and to enable your devotees to constantly relish the happiness of worshipping and meditating upon you by being present before them. Then Jiva Goswami poses a question. Krishna must take birth in the material world to give happiness to his devotees. He cannot avoid coming. Does this conflict with his independence? Krishna has to do something. It looks like he's not independent. Jiva Goswami replies that it does not. Krishna is not forced to do anything. He is free and independent. In fact, this is described in Narayana Samhita. The independent personality of God is full of all transcendental bliss. How is it possible that he needs to do anything or speak anything or is forced to do anything? It's not possible. So he continues. Essentially, he's establishing the same thing. He comes not for those reasons. He has to. There's a problem. There's a fire. He's got to put out the fire. There's a problem. He's got to fix somebody's problem. They pray to him. He's got to go take care of that problem. It's not like a, you know, switchboard operator, and there's a signal coming in. He's got to patch this one with that one. That's not Krishna. But there's his devotee, Arjuna. And Arjuna just is in rapt attention and love of Krishna, and so Krishna comes to be present, like with Narada from the previous chapter. The previous chapter was Narada became a perfected soul by the association of sages, and his faction exchanges with those sages, and he followed what they said and he became perfect. So, and now in the stage of perfection, he doesn't need anything. He just sings the glories of Krishna, goes everywhere on the Lord's behalf and spreads his glories. So Arjuna's not Narada. Arjuna's a warrior. He's serving Krishna in a different capacity. And so, as a warrior, here he goes, admonishing Ashwatthama, and Ashwatthama turns and fires a Brahmastra. So here's a difficulty for Arjuna. But Krishna's by his side not just to help Arjuna with the problem, like Draupadi. When Draupadi was being disrobed, Krishna came, but it was certainly to protect her from being violated. But it was a reciprocation of love, that the difficulty was to intensify her affection for Krishna. Or when Vyas came to seek some food with his 60,000 disciples sent by Duryodhana, and there was nothing left because her Akshayapatra was empty. And Durvasa's rage could really just destroy everything. So Krishna came, took the little piece of shakram from the side of the pot. And it's just reciprocation of love. For Krishna's presence is for reciprocation of love. And that's the lesson for us. You need not cry out to Krishna to solve a problem. If we're situated in pure devotion, we need not do that. If we're not in pure devotion, we may need to do that. But for one who's situated in pure devotion, it's Krishna's presence is to reciprocate love. Like a child. A child doesn't have to ask, "Mommy, can you feed me? Here comes some danger, can you take care of me? It's cold, can you get me a jacket?" You know that a loving parent will automatically do that. The deeper value of a relationship, a loving relationship, is the exchange of love. And that's Krishna. One with whom we can exchange love to our heart's content. And where is there a person that doesn't want to love and be loved? Everyone wants to love and be loved. But we're opposing our desire to love and be loved on fallible objects instead of the infallible Supreme. So if we impose our loving propensity upon the infallible Supreme, we're fully satisfied, and not only that, our other relationships also become spiritualized and spiritually fulfilling. And there's the absence of that spiritual fulfillment because we're not placing loving propensity upon the Supreme, or putting Krishna in the center of all of our relationships. Society, family, etc. I'll end with this idea. This is the first entrance of Krishna into the Bhagavatam. This is the topic: loving relationships between Krishna and his devotee. And in that loving relationship, ignorance is gone, fear is gone, the whole of material existence, although Arjuna is there, here comes this Brahmastra, it's not affecting him. Krishna is going to give him the intelligence, what to do. That intelligence is going to be effective. Arjuna is going to be protected. The essence is loving relationships with Krishna. And that's why Krishna comes. And that's the reward of the devotee for the full surrender to Krishna. It's a loving relationship. Without full surrender, we're not going to have a loving relationship with anyone. We'll always be the something is missing feeling in relationships because it's materially based. I want you supply, so we have a relationship. We'll never know what the fulfillment of love is. That's not necessary. So Sorry it's a long class, but our acharyas have looked at this section very much and it's inspiring. Any discussion? Yes.
On the topic of surrender, it seems like Narada Muni, you know, could take the mercy he received and just totally surrender. And many of us have a lot of mercy, but we don't take that opportunity all the time.
Yeah.
Or we surrender to a degree and then go back and
yeah.
surrender.
Right.
And
that's our program.
Mm-hmm.
That's our program. And so?
And so I'm just wondering, I mean, as I understand, just keep chanting and trying, but are there, I mean, to me it just seems like when you read these things, it's black and white. You either surrender or you don't surrender.
No, it doesn't say that. The whole process of relationship is in degrees, proportionate to, Prabhupada uses that phrase often, and it's like anything that's wholesome, that proportionate to our taking up something that's wholesome, we feel good. So that's supposed to, if we're thoughtful, it will encourage us to do more wholesome things. But if we're not thoughtful, then we become complacent. Now I feel comfortable. So then that's enough. So then we get in a complacent mode until it starts to feel uncomfortable again, and then, oh, I have to do something wholesome. And sadhana, which you described, is, you know, it's just practice. Sadhana vidhi sadhana bhakti, is just practicing that which is natural to the soul. When that which is natural to the soul awakens, then we just do those things naturally. Not because we have to do it, we're told to do it, if we didn't, it's a rule, we're supposed to do it. We do it because it becomes part of our nature. So a loving quality is our nature. And that's what we want to awaken, is not just go beyond the troubled state of material existence, but to our natural existence, our happy existence, a loving nature. Then it's not the material side of surrender. It's love. So vidhi helps us come to that stage of love. It's not an obligation. It's not a just spontaneous feeling, loving feeling. So we continue until that quantum of love awakens. Then it just carries on naturally. And by hearing these descriptions, it gives us, it refocuses again what the goal is. The goal isn't just overcoming some problem. The goal is coming to the stage of love. Love for Krishna. One more comment. The class was getting long, so I skipped over an important point, but here's one of the points I skipped. Prabhupada, in one purport, speaks about, it addresses the question you're asking. There's the conditional state, and there's the state of freedom. Got all these hand signals going on. there's a state of freedom. And a state of freedom is just like with Narada. He was bound. And then he became free. And in between there was association with the sages. it came to the inn where his mother was working, and so he was assisting his mother, and that brought them, brought him to the stage of freedom. So what Prabhupada writes is, it's the association of the mercy of the Lord that comes through the association of saintly persons. As Prabhupada writes, the spiritual master is the mercy representative of the Lord. Therefore, a person burning in the flames of material existence may receive the rains of mercy of the Lord through the transparent medium of the self-realized spiritual master. And he writes, the spiritual master, by his words, can penetrate into the heart of the suffering person and inject transcendental knowledge, which alone can extinguish the fire of material existence. So he's, the next verse is the Lord's Chit Shakti. Arjuna is saying, by your spiritual potency, this material existence is surpassed. But the Lord's presence is made possible the same way by the representative of the Supreme Lord. So it can be either or both. Narada pacified the heart of Vyas. And how did that happen? Because he was carrying the Lord. And how did that happen? Through the agency of association of saintly persons. And his taking the instructions, within those instructions was the potency to deliver Krishna. But the rain of mercy puts out the fire of eternal existence. You just have to stand within the rain and get wet. Be eager recipients of descending mercy. Krishna wants to give himself. Krishna gives himself. If we are ready to receive Krishna the way that Krishna wants to give himself, we can receive Krishna fully.
It appears that most of Pandavas were very fortunate to have natural attachment to Krishna.
Yeah. So much.
And most of the people in this position, there is no attachment. And there isn't even strong desire.
But for the rest of us, there is. So what to do? Yeah.
How to come to even developing the desire strong?
Well, the previous chapter expressed all of that. Narada was giving his own autobiography of how he was a conditioned soul, like all the rest of us. He wasn't a Pandava. It wasn't Narada, he was a conditioned soul. And same as the response over here, through the association of saintly persons in his previous lifetime, Narada got some mercy. He was just like hanging out with his mother and, you know, doing Sudra service. But through the association of those sages who showed affection upon him, and he became attached to them and served them in simple, humble ways, and heard their discourses, and became attracted to their discourses, and they further instructed him in confidential matters, and initiated him into sacred mantra, and he just kept going through that association. And even they left, he kept going. It wasn't dependent upon their physical presence, it was, he had received a very, very valuable gift, their mercy. He kept nurturing that gift. And he saw the Supreme Lord, and then the Supreme Lord disappeared. And the Lord said, I've shown myself to you just so that it will increase your hankering for me, even though you are not qualified to see me. I came. Special mercy. Now continue your life in this way. to achieve my abode. You have a spiritual form where you can enter into my internal association. Keep going. So, he did. So, through association and taking the value of that association in the right way. Taking, so, same as the message here, taking up the instructions and fulfilling them. But there's, within the instructions, there's particles of mercy that enable one to fulfill the instruction and receive Krishna from the heart. So it's, there's the vidhi part where it looks like we're doing things that we're supposed to do and not doing the things we're not supposed to do, and that's like good for us. We're purifying ourselves. But it's more than that. It's receiving, qualifying ourselves to receive Krishna in a personal relationship through that medium of association. That descending mercy. That changes the material situation to a spiritual. And all that we have to do is be a little eager to receive it. And be grateful when we receive it, and then stay with it. We stay present with that mercy. It grows into love. Gratitude grows into love.
No, I just want to, you know, I have to, the same type of question, the same continuation of the topic, descending mercy. My personal experience is sometimes you're very eager for it and it just doesn't seem to come, just won't come. And sometimes you seemingly do nothing to deserve it, and yet it's there. And it just, you know, manifests beautifully. But yet there's the logic part that says, if I apply myself with, you know, my desire, bhakti, it should come. So it's the most sublime and mystical thing, and I can't understand descending mercy and how it really works. I just can't. I know it exists, but I don't understand how it really works.
Well, therefore, descending mercy is called causeless. So, knowing that it's causeless, what should we do? Kind of like hang out and wait for it to happen because it's causeless? Or should we show to Krishna our desire to receive His mercy, even though we're not qualified? To receive His mercy is a causeless event. But we're eager. Even we have no qualification. And Krishna's not bound. He's part of what's going on is Krishna's showing He's independent. We can't stamp our little foot and say, hurry up, Krishna. I did X, Y, and Z, now it's your turn. Not contractual. Not a business deal. He's independent, we're dependent. He's the master, we're the servant. So, let us learn that when you surrender to Krishna, you surrender on His terms. Because that's what surrender means. And He can do whatever He likes. And He does. And that's just fine, because that's His position. And what's our position? We're the servant. Well, we know that He's loving. So even if it's the valley instead of on top of the mountain, we know that Krishna is merciful and loving. And it's part of our relationship with Krishna that to maintain our humility and sense of dependence. Why was Draupadi, just referred to before, put in such a terrible situation? What she did wrong? But she wasn't going, you know, Krishna, why are you doing this to me? I've done nothing wrong. She was challenging the elders. Speak. This is unrighteous. You're the protectors. Speak. And they were silent. Only Vidura spoke. Bhishmadev remained silent. Pukacharya remained silent. And that only encouraged Dushasana. And then forcibly. So, why wasn't the mercy coming? The mercy was coming. To this day, we're glorifying Draupadi. Her full dependence upon Krishna and the reciprocation of protection and love that Krishna extended. She wasn't whining and complaining. So we should. Just like when chanting the holy name, sometimes, like you described, sometimes it just seems struggle, just dry and what's wrong, and Krishna, and the valley. But sometimes those are very, while it's in one sense painful, it's ecstatic. It's full dependence upon Krishna time. So that when the mercy is showering down, it's with the full dependence upon Krishna, it doesn't escape us. And then we're thinking, now we're the enjoyer of the success of our material efforts, I mean our spiritual efforts. That's another anartha. Trying to be the enjoyer of our little successes of spiritual effort. It's another maya. It's another covering. So, be happy in the position of being dependent in a loving exchange with Krishna. And know that it's not like a loving relationship with another person who is imperfect like I'm imperfect. In this case, Krishna is not imperfect. It's perfect. Krishna knows exactly what I need. Although I've got my other idea of how it should be, and Krishna is just not performing properly. Krishna knows exactly what I need. He's very loving. So we just have to learn to surrender on Krishna's terms and be happy. And so then if it's, you know, the distresses of the Pandavas and Queen Kunti and Draupadi, you know what that's about. It's nice. What did Queen Kunti say? More. Again and again. That's the high platform, and we're not on that high platform, so we want to complain. And that's our, you know, that's our shortcoming. We've got our shortcomings. We want Krishna to lift us beyond our shortcomings. So we're back to the, you know, looking at what's the quality or degree of our surrender again. We want to be comfortable. Or do we want a loving relationship with Krishna? That's our choice, you know. We want to be comfortable. And we have our definition of what comfortable means, which changes from time to time also. We're not consistent. We're not stipapogya. Krishna Krishna wants to bring us to that position. So he does that which helps us come to that position. So we're fixed in our loving relationship with him. It works like that. If there's sincerity behind all the rest of what's going on, Krishna helps us. Only Krishna will help us. Anything else?
In our loving relationships, complete surrender to Krishna.
In our loving relationships, something about complete surrender to Krishna.
Yeah. You were saying that whatever position we are in, just surrender, and that's how we can get the
from whatever position we're in, we just surrender, and that's how we can reach Krishna.
Right.
Sure.
Is there any situation that we can change?
Is there any situation that he... He can change anything. And if he can change anything, well, why? What about this situation? Why is he not changing this situation? That's the question. Because if that situation would change, oh, it would be so much nicer and easier and better. Why didn't he just change that situation? That's the question. Not exactly.
Can we try to change?
Is that your question?
There can be changes in the situation, but how do you think that it is Krishna's arrangement or something that can be changed?
Well, Krishna's arrangement could be an obstacle. And if we face the obstacle, the first, like before you even begin doing anything, you should approach Krishna in a mood of service. Krishna, what do you want? Here's a situation that appears quite obvious. It's not right. It's not what you would want. But here's the situation, and it's not what you would want. I'm your servant. You're the master. How would you like me to address myself to this situation that's not what you want? So your mood is a mood of service, not a mood of controlling something. It isn't what it should be, so I got to go out and control that thing. Your position is a servant. Krishna is giving you some service.
And the outcome could be anything.
The outcome is up to Krishna. Let's take Prabhupada's example. He was sent by his spiritual master to do a certain service. Go to the Western countries, present this message of pure devotional service in English language to people who have never heard it before. So he came. Nothing happened. Some bad things happened. Some crazy people did some crazy things. So now he's got a situation that Krishna doesn't want. His business wasn't to control the situation. His business was to be the servant. And he stayed in that mood of service. But nothing was happening. And then Krishna arranged for something to happen. The circumstance changed. He was serving with the best of intelligence that Krishna gave him, the whatever the facility that Krishna gave him, and he just carried on serving. And the beginnings were very humble, but then when Krishna started presenting success and more success and grand success, he didn't get puffed up and proud, thinking, oh, just see what I've done. He stayed in the mood of service. So whether it's a hill or a valley, it's service to do that which Krishna wants. So Krishna is bringing some situation that looks like it's not what Krishna wants, but what Krishna wants is some service. So he's giving us some service in a way that is arranged by him. We could say, I don't like that, I want another service. Change the situation, change the channel. I want another one. Please. But, you know, we've given some service, we've given some situation, we serve Krishna. If he wants to change it, he can change it. We just, our position is to be Krishna's loving servant. And as we carry that consciousness, then it spiritualizes the whole atmosphere. And that higher purpose that Krishna wants then becomes possible through the medium of that mode of service and the spiritual atmosphere generated. And in the case of Prabhupada's example, it took a whole year. And you know, we're not Prabhupada. A whole year, nothing. He was living in a place with crazy people. Or was living in a place where there wasn't even a bathroom or toilet or shower. The office of Dr. Mishra on 72nd Street. You know, a Pukka Vaishnava that couldn't even take a bath. Horrible. But somehow he survived. So the difficult circumstance changed to another difficult circumstance, to another difficult circumstance, and then he had an apartment where some devotees were taking care of the cost of the rent of that apartment, and he was giving them Krishna consciousness. And then things started to move. So we should always stay in the mood of service. Look to what Krishna wants and serve accordingly. Okay.
You're engaged in a service, you're trying your best, so you're quoting Prabhupada, and sometimes Prabhupada, whenever he looked at some big building, he wanted this as the temple, and he put all efforts to get this as a temple. Finally, it didn't work out, and so he moved out. He was in the consciousness to understand this is not what Krishna wants. But the problem is, when we try to do something, sometimes it's not our effort to. Our effort is not 100%. So it is very difficult to understand. Is it because of my failure that I'm not able to do the best? Or is it Krishna doesn't want? So how do you really understand? Because you're not at that position.
If you're not at that position, then you try to access those that are, or you go forward with the best understanding that you have, and you're eager for some signal from Krishna. What does Krishna want? I give a practical example. This is happening like this weekend elsewhere. We had this very nice retreat in Gitanagari. And some people became very inspired. Said, let's see what we can do to help that farm project. And my response was, you're give some help. Here's some practical ABC ways you can help. But you're so excited about agriculture and that kind of, you know, we had a more extended discussion. Maybe it's something that Krishna might, you know, it might be a nice way to serve Krishna in your location. you know, some small piece of land and do some agriculture rather than something that's on the other side of the country. Oh, that's so there's an idea. Now the idea has grown. There's another person that said, my thing is I just want to grow vegetables. And I haven't heard too many people say that. I just have this passion to grow vegetables. I'd like to grow vegetables for the three temples in our area. You have any ideas, Maharaj? I said, why don't you talk to this other fellow? He has some ideas. So they started talking. Then it was some piece of land, and now it's there's a little farm property in foreclosure, and the little old lady can't keep up the mortgage. And somehow she knows something about Krishna consciousness, so she has this idea. You just take over the mortgage. Well, maybe that's something Krishna wants. You know, no money down, and just take over the mortgage. But, you know, maybe it's not what Krishna wants. Maybe it's, you know, watch out, it's a blindsided, you know, dark alley. So they're proceeding. These two devotees, the one who wants to grow vegetables and the one that wants to, you know, eventually have like a little farm community. So then Pritrashrava got in the act. This is the Chicago area. Pritrashrava said, you start going down this path, you know, let me know, because I'd like to just, I'm real excited. So it seems to be picking up some momentum. Who knows? Maybe it's a trick of Maya. Watch out. But let's just keep going down the path and see. If it falls together, you know, how's the mortgage, it's $660 mortgage, how's that going to get paid? There's a farmhouse that will be empty. Maybe it can be rented, or maybe some family wants to go there and pay the mortgage and also do some equity. Let's see what Krishna arranges. But it started with just an idea. And now we're testing the waters. It's like Prabhupada gives this example of testing ice. So, you know, I was thinking that we're testing Lake Calhoun. Mm-hmm. There's all these sailboats out there now, but what happens in the wintertime? There's no sailboats, it's ice. So in the beginning of the winter, I'm sure there's like people want to skate or do whatever it is they do on the ice. So what do? Little pressure, and you listen. If you hear the ice crack, whoa, it's not ready. I grew up on a lake too, so I know the program. And after some time, little step, you listen for the crack, little step. And after some time, zoom, zoom, off you go. Skating and, you know, sailing with skates and all these things. Snowmobiles and zoom, zoom, zoom. You proceed with caution, not with passion. I got to make this happen because Krishna wants it. Let's see if Krishna wants it. If you're not on the platform that Prabhupada was, then you know what Krishna wants. You consult with others or brahmanas and see what their wisdom says, and then have a practical plan. And be ready if you move forward with, even with a practical plan. If some indication comes Krishna doesn't want it, you're detached. Because what you want is what Krishna wants. Yeah? Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
So it's Prabhupada Swami Ki Jai.